All right. Let's see. On tithing, when you're retired over 66 on a fixed income, Social Security, and disability pension, is it an offer or a tithe when you give monthly?
Okay. Great question. We do cover this in the tithing teaching, just to encourage people to go listen to the tithing teaching. Tithing and offerings are very different. We tithe on lucrative gain from effort. And by effort, that doesn't necessarily mean you're physically doing an effort. I mean, you can invest it in something, which is an effort you made. You chose to invest your money, and it then brought back an increase, okay? So, retirement, if you have a good lucrative retirement from your job, that was from an effort to some degree. But Social Security, disability, any of those kind of things are not lucrative. Those are what's called benevolence. That's actually being provided by an insurance program called Social Security, because it's SSI, Social Security Insurance. All right, so you have, these things are not tithable. That doesn't mean you can't make an offering if you want, but it wouldn't be called a tithe, all right? The requirement to tithe is on increase from effort to gain. So you work, you produce, you get an increase. You invest, it produces, you get an increase, all right? Some of you are really funny because you want to tithe on your tax refund. Why? That's not an increase. You should have already paid a tithe on the income in the first place. Now, of course, if you only tithe on the net, you might have something to do there, because that's money you didn't tithe on. But if you tithe on the gross, you already tithed. Now, some of you may be so excited about the refund and not need it all, you might want to make an offering. That's up to you. I don't see, you know, why you would or wouldn't do that. That's purely your choice. So I'm certainly not encouraging you to do that. But I'm saying is, if you are finding yourself with a windfall of some sort, okay, an inheritance, you know, some sort of thing that you get as a gift that's just somehow, or maybe you go to move and you sell your house and you realize, wow, I'm getting so much more than I ever thought I would get. I'd like to show my appreciation by making an offering. That's fine. Remember, offerings are not obligated in themselves. Three times a year you are, but every time something is good in your life that's happening and you know it came from above, it's probably a good idea to give some sort of an offering. But that's not detailed in what that should look like, or that comes out of your heart. But the tithing is obligated. It's mandatory. But it's only mandatory for that which you made an effort to create an increase. Okay? Otherwise, it's not. Okay? When you have a family member all of a sudden that decides to give you a bunch of money, well, that's great. They gave you a bunch of money. Make an offering if you really want to. Okay? You're not obligated to, but you could. It's not tithable. You didn't do anything to get it except be related. Okay? Which may be a lot of effort, actually, to be related to some people. It's a lot of effort. But... I'm sorry. Did that come out loud? I didn't mean that. So you may deserve every penny of that and more, but and have earned it. But you understand what I'm saying? So for all of you on disability, on Social Security, on what you call fixed income, no, you do not have. Now, I know that it's hard, because here's the funny thing. I've got all of these people like this person, you know, Gary, who put that question in there, who they want to tithe. And I got a bunch of people who absolutely can and should who don't and don't want to. But I got all these people with almost nothing, but they want to tithe. And so you know what? You can give a 10% offering. It's not a tithe, but it's 10%, and it's an offering. You can give whatever your heart moves you. Just understand that the requirement doesn't exist for this type of income. But let's say you worked a really great career, and your company gave you a really great package when you retired, and you're getting a few thousand dollars a month as part of that retirement on top of all this other stuff the government gives you. Well, you earned all that. So that might be something you would tithe on, because you worked a career to get that benefit, ongoing income. Okay? All right, good question. Next question.
All right, would it be correct that in Yeshua's sermon about divorce, idolatry would fall into the grounds of fornication as he declares it the only grounds for divorce?
Okay, so we are going to have a teaching called Sex 101. Everybody's looking forward to that one. Let's understand that there are some challenges in understanding the book we have, because it was not written in English. And almost all of us are reading it in English. And it's been handled and mishandled and translated in all kinds of bizarre ways. So let's first understand that when Yeshua is speaking, he's not speaking about divorce. Okay? Because it says here, would it be correct that Yeshua's sermon about divorce? He never had a sermon about divorce. Okay? He was talking about putting away. It's a different thing. The Greek doesn't say divorce. There's a different word for that. It says putting away. Because if you, and then we also have to understand the idea of fornication or porneo versus adultery. Because people will say, well, you can only get a divorce for adultery. No, adultery gets you killed. Okay? Stoning is the result of adultery, not divorce. Okay? Or putting away. But then we have to wonder what this porneo is or this fornication is. And it's a very strange term only because it seems to have something to do. I think it doesn't just seem. It's clear that it's sexual in nature, but it's not really clear what the extent of that nature is. Okay? And so I will be covering that much more clearly when I get to the teaching. I'm really am going to do something to explain all this. And but to give it to you this way, it would be any kind of inappropriate sexual interaction with somebody you shouldn't be doing it with, but not necessarily adultery. Now, it seems, this is going to trip you up, and please listen, it's hard. It seems that it's only called adultery when both people doing it are married, okay? And not to each other, okay? All right? In other words, a married person having that kind of relations with someone who's single is not called adultery. This is probably where it falls into this. Porneo or fornication or some other sexual thing that's wrong to do. But adultery, it seems, is only when both are married and not to each other. And then they are both taken and they're both stoned. Okay, we clear with that? Because otherwise we don't have an understanding of this. Because this, for years, we've all been told that the only reason to get divorced is adultery. No! Adultery got you killed. So this can't be that. So there has to be something different. And so I haven't completely fleshed it out. Okay? Gotten the full understanding of this. But this is where I'm starting to lean as far as understanding is that there is this relational stuff, the sexual relational stuff that's not appropriate scripturally, that you should not be doing in being a married person. Now, we have other things to deal with. What is it? Two single people, and how does that all work? All these terms are ways of labeling, as you'll see, the same thing we talked about evil, and we're going to talk about sin. The label has to do with the status of the person being labeled. Okay? When somebody does something in a status called covenant, it may be called sin. Outside of covenant, it's still not good to do, but it might not be called sin. I know that gets me in trouble and everybody gets mad. I'm going to do the teaching and make my case. And so when you do something in marriage, it's wonderful. When you do it with somebody, if you're in marriage and they're also married, but not to you, it's called adultery. If you do something, you understand, there's ways to label it. Doesn't make it any less wrong. Because if you do it this way, as Yeshua was talking about it, you get put away. What is put away? Go listen to the teaching on divorce, remarriage, and putting away. Putting away is publicly being marked for this behavior. Now, and not only that, but that means that the public now knows that you should never be allowed to marry anybody. That's a heavy consequence. You may want to be stoned. I'm just saying, that's a very strong deterrent. That if you did this, you would be publicly shamed, like a scarlet letter written on you or whatever, that you could not get married. The person you were married to could, but you couldn't. And they wouldn't have to divorce you. You wouldn't get stoned, but you would be put away. This is why we have this interesting line in the beginning of Matthew where, Yeshua's father, not his father, but not the heavenly father, but Joseph, decides he's going to put Miriam away quietly, which is not something that was done. The whole point of putting away was very loud and in public. so that everybody knew. Just like getting married is very loud and in public, so everybody knows you're married. So they know that you're now no longer available to anybody else. Okay? So both directions, it's done in a very public way. Now, divorce wasn't done so publicly, but you were handed a document that said you were divorced and set free. That's never mentioned in the things that Yeshua is talking about. Okay? It's called a Sefer Kritut, okay, which is this document that says you're divorced. It's a writ of divorce. And you'd have that. Okay, now you also would be put outside, but it's not the putting away. In other words, if you're kicked out of the house, so to speak, and given the Sefer Kritut, you're divorced. And then you're free now to marry anybody, do anything you want. Well, within the confines of Torah, right? But you were now free as if you were a legitimately single person and no longer responsible for the marriage you had before. So hopefully that kind of helps here. But let's understand the challenge we have, because people will say, but it says that God hates divorce, and I'm telling you, it never says that anywhere. It's a bad translation. The word in the Greek and the Hebrew never says that. But in English, it says it in all your Bibles. That's a problem. For you, it's not a problem in general, because if you dig under it, if you have a teacher that could help you understand. But it doesn't say that, okay? And we need to understand and accept that reality. It doesn't say what you want it to say or what your Baptist pastor told you all your life or whatever charismatic. Well, it doesn't matter. Wherever you learned it in Catholic school, it doesn't matter. It doesn't say it. It says it in English, yes. It wasn't written in English. It wasn't even probably written in Greek. Probably written in Hebrew first. But the Greek doesn't have it that way either. Okay? And you can understand that because the way it's describing it isn't describing a situation that would lead to divorce. So then what would lead to divorce? Anything. Two people deciding they don't want to be married. I don't want to callously make this like this simple thing. Divorce, I counsel a lot of people on the brink of divorce on a regular basis. It's not a good option. I talk to a lot of people that have been divorced, and it is not a good option. It may, though, be better than being miserable and tortured in the relationship you're in. That's a hard choice. Okay? I know people don't like when I say this, but marriage is not the only dumb thing you have that if you do it, you're stuck with it. Okay? Because almost every other dumb thing you can fix and you can make a different choice. But if you marry somebody you shouldn't have married and it turned out to be a bad idea, Christianity has told you you're stuck. But you're not. That doesn't mean that there aren't negative things that are going to be consequences of divorce too. Everybody I know that's divorced still has some issues with their exes, or they have issues about the children, or there's issues that will come. There's no getting around that there will be issues. However, it may still be better, not usually probably, but may in some circumstances be better than staying together. And I encourage people to seriously, you know, think it through, because I tell people who want to get divorced all the time, have you thought about what that would look like? Have you really thought about what life would be like, you know, by yourself now and changing things and going through all that and how the children will treat you and whatever, all the family? I mean, you're bringing on a whole new set of fun, you know, so to speak. And I mean that with all the sarcasm I can muster, okay? But it's allowable. And when you want to know why, as far as like what causes, anything. You don't need anything to get divorced, except two people no longer wanting to be together, all right? It could, and by the way, it could be simply breach of contract of your own covenants. You expected certain things of each other, and it's not happening, and you finally get to the point where you've had enough of that. Because that's how Yahweh does with Israel. He basically divorces them. He says, you guys, you know, you guys, I've had enough of your behavior. So go. Go do whatever you want. Let's just understand that. Okay, next.
Should I feel bad if I can't bring myself to attend my 8-year-old grandson's church choir or other events at the Baptist church? His mom has him going on Sundays.
It seems like there was two questions in that. Okay, the first question seems like, should I feel bad about going? The other is, maybe should you feel bad about the fact that he's being forced to go? I don't know if that was the second question in there. Okay, because it says his mom has him going to these things on Sundays. Let's deal with the second part, which is the question I added that you didn't ask, which is a lot of people have this struggle, though, you have to recognize that you can't emotionally be wrapped into what other people do like that, especially when they're not your responsibility. Your grandchildren aren't yours. It hurts a lot of grandparents. They're your children's children, not yours. Okay? You do have a relationship, barely. All right? And only to whatever level they let you. But you don't have any authority, not really, and you don't have any responsibility. It's all on the parents and on those kids. And so you have to disconnect emotionally from that negative stuff. You can't allow yourself to get hurt so much watching your grandchildren do things they shouldn't do. And there's a lot of other things that I get on a regular basis from people that their grandchildren are going and doing this and their parents are letting them do that. Well, that's between, if you have a problem, talk to your children. You do have a relationship with them, but they're not your kids. The grandkids are not your kids. So if the grandchildren are children of your son, then you go ahead and talk to your son and say, look, son, I know that you're kids and you're an adult now, but I really would like to talk to you about what you're doing with these kids. And if it's your daughter's kids, they say to your daughter the same thing. But realize they don't have to listen to you. They're adults and it's their kids. They're not yours. I've had to tell at one point both my parents and my wife's parents not to get involved in certain things that were because they were not their kids when they wanted to correct my kids. Okay? So I'm not saying it was either. Both parents made the same mistake. It's a typical grandparent mistake. Grandparents think they have authority over everything. They do. And they also think they can do whatever they want. Nobody should ever stop them. Especially grandmas. Well, I'm grandma. I'll do what I want. Not in my house and not with my kids. And I told both of them to stop. Especially because I was standing right there. I said, excuse me, I'm here. I can correct them. You don't need to do that. They're not yours. They're mine. Okay? Now, the feeling bad about not going. It's certainly reasonable that you will have emotional challenges when you don't get to do something you'd love to do because it's being done in a church on a Sunday, whatever it is that you don't want to do. You don't want to be involved in because it's, or they're doing it on a Sabbath somewhere and you can't break the Sabbath to do it. You'll miss weddings that you'll regret missing, but you'll have to miss them. You'll feel bad though. You'll feel bad because you'll want to be there and you don't want to cause them to be upset with you. Although we've heard some really good testimonies, especially back in Unleavened Bread, of somebody who didn't go to a wedding, and the person whose wedding it was got the rest of the family to appreciate that she respected why her aunt didn't come, okay? Or whatever it was, okay? But you have to make your stands. Yes, you might feel bad, but you have to not let that drive your decision-making. What have I talked about now over and over and over again? You cannot let your emotions drive your decisions. That's a almost surefire, path to disaster, okay? All of you, absolutely, if you're more than like 3 seconds old, actually, probably as long as you're like 8 or 9 or 10 years old, at some point you start to realize making decisions when you're upset and you're emotional or overly excited and emotional generally doesn't go well. Some point you figure that out. Now, but you don't figure it out enough to stop doing it. But you figure it out. But you have to get to the point where you stop doing it, right? So when it says, should I feel bad if I can't bring myself to attend? No, you shouldn't feel bad from a decision-making, but just you might be sad. I really wish I could go. I would love to be there, but I'm not going to go there and listen to them sing Christian choir songs in a Sunday church and all this stuff. I wouldn't go for lots of reasons. One of the, if nothing else, I don't think I could sit there and listen to it. Okay? I don't. There are some congregations that I'll put on just to see what they're doing, and they'll be singing, really standard Christian hymns. I don't know their hymns or not because I didn't grow up in that, but I'll be playing something and then Elder Billy walked by and goes, by the way, that's a mainstream Christian hymn from goes back centuries. Because I'm just sitting there going, look, can you believe what they're doing in these places? And this is supposed to be Messianic Sabbath keeping, Torah keeping. And I couldn't sit there and do that. I don't care how good the teaching is. I don't care how good. I couldn't sit there and listen to that. Okay? And so if I have relatives, which I don't, but if I had that invited me to things like this, I wouldn't go. Would I feel bad? I would miss it. I would miss being there for the child. Okay, if you've ever seen me and see the way the children run up and grab a hold of me at the end of service, everything, I love children. And so if this is an 8-year-old and I'm relatively close, if that's a grandchild or if it's a, you know, if it's a nephew or something, I would love to be there. But I'm not doing this. So I might be sad that I don't get to do it. I'd be sad that that's what they're actually doing. But I'm not going to feel bad about it. Okay, I'm going to feel good that I'm making the right decision. So don't feel bad, but it's okay if you feel sad. How's that? All right, next.
All right, where should I tithe? Should it be to help others more local?
All right, this is a really good question. Again, I recommend to all those asking tithing questions, listen to the tithing teaching, okay? Tithe versus offerings, all right? The tithe itself has a purpose. The purpose is to provide for the full-time functioning of ministry. This is scriptural. The priests were to be full-time ministering to the people through the temple service. The tithe was actually first given, we see in scripture, to Melchizedek, who was also ministering, but he was ministering in Torah teaching, not in temple service. The Melchizedekian priesthood teaches Torah, and the Levitical priesthood does judging and does the temple service. And so the tithe is to support that, so you have those Deuteronomy 17 guys available to you all the time. So that means that you give your tithe to where your ministry is, that's feeding you, providing the covering for you, answering your questions and guiding you. Okay, this is a vertical structure we're supposed to be in. So if you're in the vertical structure, some of you are like all over the place and there is that vertical's there, but you kind of go here and you go here. So you're not actually under a vertical structure. But if you are, the tithe should go to that. So if you're in a local congregation, your tithe should go to your local congregation. It doesn't go to speakers all over the world. It doesn't go to, you know, $5. I had a person tell me, well, I give $5 here and $20 here, and I do that. That's the way I give my tithe. That's not tithing. Those are offerings, okay? A tithe was given to support the full-time ability of to someone to be full-time in ministry to minister to you. So if you're watching, because obviously the people locally here, this is a local congregation, their tithe should be here. If you're watching and you go to a local congregation, but you happen to also be watching this, then you should be tithing to your local congregation. Now, let's say that this is your local congregation. You don't have one to go to. Then you would do as a lot of people do, is send it here. You can mail it here. You can go on Givelify on our donation button, and you can do it that way. And a lot of people do. Probably most of our funding comes that way because there's more people out there than there are here that are connected to or being served by what we're doing as a ministry. All right? Because you're wanting to support those that are serving you so they can do it full time and do the bigger things that are necessary, like provide the feast events. We just had a Passover event here, Passover Unleavened Bread. We had over 400 people here. To do that, we spent well over, not just, you know, at this event here, but over time as we bought a tent that we've now been using. We bought a floor for the tent. We paid and rented lighting and bathrooms and all kinds of other. We spent easily over $100,000 on all of that. Okay? Hold on. I don't want you to clap. Okay? I mean, the tent alone was, I forget how much, like 30 or 50 or whatever it was. And then the floor was like more than that even for the floor and the different things. And I'm not saying that to say anything except the fact that we did not charge enough for the event to pay for that. You know how we paid for that? Because people needed this and they supported it through tithes and offerings so that we could serve you, okay? We didn't charge anywhere near enough to pay for what we spent. And that's not trying to get you to send more. I'm telling you, because you do send, we're able to do. So I don't want you to think, well, you know, I see all these people. How could any one person need the money from all these people just for a salary? Not much of it goes to my salary compared to what it goes to everything else. There's enough so I can be full-time. And actually, so Elder Billy can be full-time and Rabbi Tom can be full-time. Because we have so many, we need multiple people to be full-time. And then we have Marlene full-time so she can answer the phones and do all the stuff that we need administratively. Okay, so we have need for someone to make sure that everything's maintained, and we have someone that helps maintain the building and thing. I mean, we have people that you support that so this can exist so that we can function for all of this. You guys who are watching on live stream, we've got, I can't even tell you how many $1,000s worth of cameras so that you can have the best quality experience that we can provide you. And again, that's us serving you, and that's what your money goes to, so that we can serve you as effectively as we can, right? So that's what the tithing goes for, so that we can provide those things to minister to you. Okay, because I know sometimes people think, because they watch the TV and they see the guys with the, you know, 40,000 square foot houses and 15 cars and 3 airplanes, they think that's what their tithe is for. No. Okay? I get a salary. Okay? All the rest of it goes to all of this, and benevolence especially. Okay, we take care of a lot of people in a lot of ways. And so you want to tithe to the ministry that's ministering to you on a regular basis. I'll ask you the question that you should be asking yourself. When you have a problem or a question, who do you call? Whoever that is, that's where, if that ministry is probably where you need to be tithing. Okay? The one who's serving you when you need something, that's who needs your support. Matter of fact, I would love to ask people before I help them, are you tithing? I mean, you want my help. Are you supporting this? Okay. Because I know a lot of them come on a regular basis and don't. And I still help them anyway. And you know why? Because the rest of you are supporting me, my ability to do that. And maybe one day the light bulb will go on for them and they'll start doing it too. But this is what you need to understand. There are things that we need as a body, and those are things that are supported by the tithes. You know, we have a property. That property's 130-something acres. We want to build on it, and we're in the process. I saw the architect Friday, yesterday. Had a nice lunch with them, around lunchtime anyway. We had a nice meeting and talking about the new building we're going to be putting together and the dining hall and some of the other things for this property. But you know what? I asked them for an estimate of what they thought the project would cost, and it was a fairly large eye-popping number. Okay? Considering we have to bring infrastructure in, and we're going to have to bring in a lot of stuff that's not... I mean, this is a big open space property, right? And you know, we're talking in the range of, like, I don't know, $10, $12 million. Okay, for like 2 buildings and the infrastructure and being able to house and sit like 600 to 1,000 people. Okay? And put all of the equipment in there and the seats and all the other, and the dining hall and the kitchen. That's so that we can serve the body with the best possible feast experience on our own property. Because I'll tell you what, if you were here for this one, we fit the maximum we could fit in here for Passover for the meal. 390 people, that's all we could fit. Okay? 65 tables full. And now I'm going to be forced to do something I hate to do. I'm going to have to tell people there's a cutoff for our meals because we won't be able to, if we get more than 390 people trying to book a meal, I won't have room. Because that's as many, we put as many people as we could fit in this room, and that was it. That was hard to serve all of that. It went great, but it was, you know, it's a challenge. So I want another facility where we can handle a lot more than that. Wouldn't you want to be able to have that? Okay. And again, I'm not asking you to do anything financially. I'm simply saying is that's where, when the tithes are sufficient, we can do these things. As a matter of fact, the third building we want to build, we're going to build the main congregation hall, like the assembly hall, and then we're going to build the dining hall, is the yeshiva. And the yeshiva academy is going to be where we can have homeschoolers, you know, so people will have an academy. Like we tried that for like a year or two, and now we're going to actually eventually have a real academy for the children. We're going to have a yeshiva training center for men to be trained in ministry. Okay? And so all these things are going to require a building to do them in, which that'll add another who knows what to the price at some point, right? And so, you know, so when people ask sometimes about, you know, where should I tithe and about tithing, just understand that it's to provide the services for you. It's about you. Where do you receive the services from? Support them so they can continue to provide and provide even more. Does that make sense? Okay, so I want you to think of it
almost from a selfish point of view. In other words, why would you be giving it any place but where you're being fed from? Okay? Now let's look at the other side of it, offerings. You can give an offering to anybody you want to bless because you appreciate that they're providing you with something. So for example, when in the past I visited a congregation, even if it wasn't my congregation, because maybe I was traveling and I went and found a congregation near wherever I was traveling, I always gave an offering in every building I ever went to because I appreciated it existed for me to go to it. So I always gave an offering. I would never walk into this building as a guest or regular and not have put an offering. Now, some of you use Givelify, and I get that, that's fine, but I would not be coming and not giving something because you want to at least express appreciation for that this exists so that you can do that. And you're thanking him for providing this through the offerings and the inspiration of other people and the tithes so that we can have this. But if you are watching a teaching somewhere by some other, whoever you're watching, and you really feel blessed, you want to give them an offering of some sort, that's an offering, okay? There are three required that you would give to where you're being fed. Those are the three feast offerings. That's the unleavened bread, Shavuot, and Sukkot, Deuteronomy 16, 16. Those are required offerings. He says, do not come empty-handed. Okay, so those three times you bring an offering. And you bring according to how you've been blessed. He says, I want you to look back at how I've blessed you over the last, between the last event and this one. Like, so when you do the one for unleavened bread, when you get to Shavuot, he says, what's happened in the last 50 days? How do you feel about what I've done for you and blessed you? Make an offering. Then between Shavuot and Sukkot, same thing. Look back on the last few months and say, wow, he's really done so much for me. I want to give something. Whatever that is, that's between you and him, right? Okay. So hopefully that answered the tithe question. That's a good question, though, okay? The only other thought I want to add to the tithing thing is the three tithes, right? The second tithe is every year. It's for you to enjoy feasts. Go listen to the teaching. I don't know why at least you wouldn't do that one. I mean, after all, it's for you. You get to enjoy that one. So I have no idea why people don't do that one. But the third one, this is where it gets confusing, the benevolence tithe, which is one time in the third and the sixth year of the seven-year cycle, right? So you have the third and the sixth year. The question always comes up, well, how do we know what year it is? The Deuteronomy 17 decision we've made at MTOI is that you start counting from the year that you came to understand to do this. As soon as you start tithing, first and second tithe, that's your first year of the cycle to get to the year three with the third tithe. Now, I'm all for rounding up and rounding down, so to speak. So it starts, the tithing cycle is a Sukkot to Sukkot cycle. Some of you might be confused with that. Why wouldn't we do it from Aviv 1 to Aviv? Because this is the way it's done, okay? I'm not going to explain it all right now, but it ends at the end of Sukkot and starts all over again, okay? That's when the beginning of your counting of years is actually in Tishrei, okay? The beginning of it, because if you look at Leviticus 25, it talks about the counting of years starts with the day after atonement, with the month with atonement in it, okay? So we count years, that's why we call it Rosh Hashanah. It's the beginning of the counting of years, okay? As opposed to saying, well, that's not the first of the year, not for counting holy days. That would be Aviv 1. But for counting years it is, because you declare the Jubilee, you declare the Shemitah based on trumpets. And atonement that month, okay? Different calendars are in your Bible. Leviticus 23 has the one for holy days. Leviticus 25 has the one for jubilees. And so it's just different calendars. But when it comes to that third tithe, that benevolence tithe, people always ask, well, can I just give it to homeless people or these people or that people in my neighborhood? I guess you could. I mean, it doesn't say, but the thing is, you're going to take that tithe. And are you going to give it to people that are the right people? When I say right people, I mean, are you going to be enabling something? Are you going to be helping to cause somebody to be more entitled? Are you going to be throwing it down a bottomless pit? Anybody ever do that? Okay, lots of you have given money to people and realized that was a mistake. So we see scriptural understanding of giving it to the priest, in this case, the Melchizedekian priest, and allowing the priests to vet that through and decide how to give that out. Because we vet to make sure that we're not enabling. We ask tough questions about why they're in the state they're in and what their plan is to get out of the state they're in before we throw any money at it, okay? And we help a lot of people, okay? We have thousands and thousands of dollars of help a year, but it's not just given out all willy-nilly, okay? And so that was an inside joke for some people, the willy-nilly part. So the key is that you can give it here. And if you give it here, we have a separate bank account just for the benevolence fund, and that money is used only to help people, okay? And so that way you know that that's what it's there for. We help people come to the feast. We help people when they, you know, something terrible happens in their life and they have some horrible immediate challenge that they plan to, they'll be able to get out of at some point, and then we help them make that plan to get out of it. But we want to know how you ended up where you are and what your plan is to get out. And if you don't have a plan to get out, then you must agree to make one with us so you have a plan to get out of the problem that you have, okay? And that's critical, okay? That's critical. All right.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
My question has to do with Shabbat, since we were talking about that earlier in conversations. Been a while back after an hour Shabbat here, we're all outside talking, and we started talking about cars and movies about cars and stuff. And on my way home, I thought that that wasn't proper. Would that be proper conversation for Shabbat or not?
Okay. This is a really challenging, I was going to say challenging subject, but it's really challenging to do. Okay, we are to keep our focus on the vertical, but it's almost impossible in a social situation to do that perfectly over the 24 hours of Shabbat, or the 12 hours, not counting whatever sleeping you did or whatever. But I mean, it's really hard to do. And so I would say, look, he wants us to love on each other and to interact with each other. And we should make an effort to try to keep the conversation from the things that we could do on when it's not Shabbat. So if you catch yourself, don't feel all horrible about it. Just change the subject, okay? I've gone up to people, and they got mad at me, but that's okay, you know, in the past and said, maybe you've talked about that enough for today. And why don't we just switch to something else, okay? Because we love each other and we find ourselves talking about common interests, or something will trigger something, and the next thing you know, you're spending an hour on it. And we don't need to be doing that on Shabbat, okay? Do I think, I don't do it perfectly. So it's hard to do perfectly, okay? Maybe you can do it 1 week perfectly, you're not gonna do it every week perfectly. Because we're just so ADHD distracted in our heads with all these other things floating around that it's hard to just stay focused vertically the whole time. Okay? Especially if you happen to not be involved, but you walk by and you hear a conversation that piques your interest because it's something you're excited about, and then next thing you know, you're sucked right into it, right? You're dragged right into that conversation. So if you can, and you're aware of it, then say, hey guys, why don't we just shift the conversation and wait until after sundown or something like that, okay? Look, I tell the story about how I got in trouble with my my sister-in-law, because one of my sister-in-laws came over after my wife had gone to Paris. And my wife, as most of you know, loves to take pictures. And so back then, we took pictures on film. You understand? Children, that's film, okay? And you had to send it out and have them develop it, and it came back, and who knew what it was going to look like? Anyway, because you didn't get to take the picture, look at it, and go, no, that didn't come out good, and take another one. You just took one and hoped it came out good. And you didn't take 15 of each picture either because it was expensive. You paid for every picture. So her sister came by. It was Shabbat, so we were going to meet and have dinner at our parents' house, and then we were going to go spend the evening together. And, of course, her sister said she wanted to see the pictures. And I said to my wife, who was almost about to take them out, nothing on her because, you know, she got wrapped up in the moment. I said, let's wait till after Shabbat. It's only another 2 hours or whatever. It's like 5 o'clock, sundown. It's like seven or whatever it was. I said, well, why don't we just wait until after sundown? And my sister-in-law got so mad that how dare you? Because then she thought I was judging her in some way. I wasn't. I just said quietly, let's just wait. And that's the way I think you should handle things. And my wife absolutely just said, no, we're not going to do it. We're going to wait. Okay? And so I would say that would be, for Harold and whoever, you know, that would be the best way to handle it. Is that try to be as aware as you can. You're going to catch yourself. Don't get angry and frustrated. Just as soon as you catch it, fix it. All right? Okay, Brandy?
Shabbat shalom, Rabbi.
Shabbat shalom.
This isn't a question. Just want to confirm that I have the right doctrine before I ask the question. So like Luke 24:45, and he opened their minds to comprehend the scriptures.
Right.
That's a gradual process as we come into this, just like when we got our bubble popped. You're not going to hear it every time. You're not going to accept it or receive it the first time you hear it every time, correct?
Okay. He specifically opened them up like right then and there because right. They were about to go do something. With the rest of us, it's a gradual process, exactly like you said.
Okay. So question number one, is that what grows the maximalism approach that you teach? If you're not doing that, have you stopped growing?
I don't know that they're connected. I think that if you're not doing it, it may be because you're stopped growing to some degree. I don't mean that not doing it means you're not growing. I mean, you may be struggling in that one area of growth. You may be growing in other areas of the walk, okay? But I often teach about progressive revelation. He's going to help you understand things. You start doing them, then you can understand more about what you're doing, and then you do them more, and then you can understand more about it, which is why I tell you to go back and listen to the teachings over and over again, because you're going to get more out of them each time that you missed the first times, because you just weren't ready to have that revealed to you on, like, maybe it wasn't that you didn't understand the teaching, but you didn't realize, hey, that part I didn't realize applies to me. Because through progressive revelation, you recognize, wait a minute, that's talking about me, where the first time I listened to it, I didn't realize it was talking about me type of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So absolutely, it could be telling you there's an area of growth that's stagnant if you're not getting there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not growing. Okay.
And how do we... No, hold on. So the feasts. There's certain... Not even just the feasts. There's certain things that we can't do because we're not in the land. Right? Those things that are Torah commanded, like keeping the feast, but we can't actually do it the way we're supposed to because there's no Levitical priesthood and there's no temple. If someone says, I'm not going to do the feast, is that a sin?
I think that everything comes down to always Deuteronomy 8:2, right? Which is he wants to see it where your heart's at. So if they're not going to do it, what's going to matter is why. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So again, this is important for all of you. I'm going to talk towards the camera here. All right. You want to be careful of the won'ts versus the can'ts. If there's a reason that you can't attend a feast, can't, right? Something you just can't do it. That's, he understands can't. He doesn't have a good thing with won't. Okay. If you can, but you choose not to because you don't want to, whatever, there's a reason you won't do it. That's different. Okay. Like the people that, you know, live maybe local to a congregation and decide, well, I'm just going to stay home this week. I don't really have a reason to. I just don't feel like it. I'm tired. I want to stay home. That's not a can't. That's a won't. And so the Deuteronomy 8:2, where he wants to see whether it's in your heart to do. So whether it's, when you ask if it's a sin, I think when you don't do what you can do and should do, you're in a place where you're missing the mark, which makes it a sin. Okay?
Okay, and then... If you work and your husband works, is your offering at the feast separate? So since you said look back at how he's blessed you, like one of you's like, he didn't bless me that much, and the other one's like, he's blessed me abundantly.
Well, I mean, look, that's, when you're talking about a husband and wife and those kind of things, I think you should talk about it together, and you should come up with something together. And you could say, this is what I would like to do, and he can say, this is what I'd like to do, and you can combine that up or adjust it in some way. But you can also just give it separately. If you're both working, you could decide, I want to give my own thing. But really, as a husband and wife, I think the offering should come together, but the tithing is individual because you're each working. So the tithing, you know, you could be tithing off of you. Now, you can still make one tithe, you know, check, so to speak, you know, combining up your incomes and doing that, but it's coming from both of you that way. But I don't think there's a yes or no there. I think it's either one is fine. Okay, you could either give it yourselves or you can give it together.
Okay.
I definitely think you should, as a husband and wife, talk about it. Okay.
And if this is a teaching, that's fine. Tell me, Yeshua was led by the Spirit in Luke, but he is the Spirit. Somebody had a question for me that was in the Christian walk, and I was like, wait. Can you explain that?
Okay, well, because we're still confusing certain terms, all right? When we're talking about Yeshua being in us, the way he's in us is through this thing called the Spirit. Okay, so it's not that he is the Spirit. And so he can be led by, the Spirit is something that the Father uses and that he uses. And when he was down here in the flesh, okay, in the flesh suit, the Father was the one primarily using the Spirit. Well, now when he's up there with the Father, they're both using it because that's part of how he gets to interact with us directly and then be inside of us, okay? So saying he is the Spirit is what's confusing the thing, okay?
But you said that's him that comes back.
Yes, but he's coming back through the means by which we call the Ruach HaKodesh. It's the means by which he's able to communicate and be with us.
Okay. I feel like there's a longer teaching because I'm not getting that. Because it's
because
I'm talking to a Christian.
I understand.
That sounds like a third entity.
Go back to the Father and Son teaching and the understanding of the Ruach teaching.
Okay.
Okay? Those should help you with that. By the way, the other thing I wanted to say about offerings, when you brought that up, unless the first thought that comes to your head is some ridiculously low number that you know you're being cheap about or whatever, it's usually good to go with whatever the first number is. In other words, he might inspire you that first number may scare you. I've had somebody tell me that recently, okay? But there's a reason it came to your head. And so I'm not telling you you have to do this. I'm saying I would strongly consider your first thought when you start thinking about him blessing you and what you want to give. And that first thought is usually the right thought, okay? Because if you look at it and think it's too low, then you know that you had a wrong thought to start with. But if you're thinking it's too big and it was the first thought, there may be a reason why it was supposed to be that way. I don't know. I'm just saying is my experience, I try to go with the first number that comes in my head. Okay, when I go to give an offering, I don't even think about it. I go, okay, I'm going to give an offering. And then usually some thought comes to me. Almost all of you probably have the same thing. And then that's probably the right number. Okay? Just something to kind of work with. And I think a lot of you are nodding like you understand and you agree. Okay? All right.
Last one. Thank you. You've been so patient. I appreciate you.
Well, this is only taken away from Janet's time, so it's okay.
It's okay. Okay.
Well, she's actually asking a question for somebody else anyway, but go ahead.
The transfiguration in Luke.
Put it by your mouth.
The transfiguration in Luke. Can you briefly discuss the state of the dead and the soul sleep doctrine? I said brief. I'll take a no.
No. I can do this briefly.
Regarding Moshe and Elijah being up
okay,
there.
Norma, pay attention. This is Millennium Kingdom Part 4. Because that's the only piece that's actually missing was the state of the dead part. Although I did cover it somewhat in the Millennium. Go back and listen to Millennium and Kingdom. I think I covered it to some degree. Okay, look. The vision in Luke, the vision that you see when the transfiguration moment, okay, with Moses and Elijah and this whole thing, right, with Yeshua, you have to understand this was in vision, okay? So it's not something that's literally happening. It wasn't a state of the dead thing. They weren't literally there. This was to give a vision to those that were there. And it was only the three of them that were there, his top three primary guys, okay? All right? And so when I say three, I mean the ones who are watching the vision. I'm not talking about Yeshua, right? So he had John, James, and Peter there, right? So they're there. And if I got that wrong, don't get mad at me. I'm remembering it being that way. And so they're seeing this in a vision. Now they think they're in the vision, they're thinking it's real. They're like, hey, should we make booths for them and get set up for them? And he's like, no. That's not what you're seeing here. I'm just giving you some insight into something. Now, he's not giving you insight into the state of the dead. Okay, this is not a state of the dead teaching that Yeshua is doing at this point. As a matter of fact, he didn't do a state of the dead teaching anywhere in his ministry. Even the Lazarus and the rich man thing was not a state of the dead teaching. Okay, he was talking about, depending on money and love of money teaching, and depending on your riches to get you somewhere. It was not about, the state of the dead. So, as far as, I know they did this in the Millennium and Kingdom teaching, there is no immortal soul as far as the word nephesh. Nephesh is often considered the soul, and it says the soul that sins shall die. That's in Jeremiah, right? So we know, I think it's in Jeremiah, and so we know that there is no such thing as an immortal soul from that point of view. Because that word nephesh simply means a living being, and living beings die. There is, however, something called the breath of life that comes into us, and that connects with us, and that's what leaves us and can be put back into a body. Okay? But that, when it leaves us, it says that the dead know nothing. It says almost everywhere it refers to them as being asleep. Okay? And awaiting the resurrection. So as far as we can tell, the state of the dead is a state of dormancy. Okay? It's like being asleep. I don't know if there's dreaming or not, but you're asleep. It may not feel like any time has passed at all, because a lot of times you go to sleep and you wake up, you don't even realize you've been asleep for 8 hours, because it just feels like a few minutes. But we will be dead as long as we're dead, and when we're resurrected, it won't feel like any amount of time at all when we come in and wake up. But we need to understand that scripturally, and I did talk about this indirectly in some other teachings on the Millennium Kingdom teachings, dead is dead. The dead know nothing. It's a place of waiting for something that's coming. Okay? And so that's why I don't understand the Christian mindset of when you die, you go to heaven or you go to hell, then what's the point? Who's being resurrected? If everybody's going somewhere as soon as they die, then and they're going to take you. I get the people that maybe in hell think they want to get pulled out of there to be put back in a body. But why would you tear people away from heaven if heaven is whatever they're describing it to be and then stick them back in a flesh suit just to be judged? It doesn't make any sense. But everything scripturally is awaiting the resurrection. Which means that, and he says, by the way, in Hebrews 11, Paul tells us, hey, those that were all these heroes, by faith they did this and by faith they did that. He says, every one of these died having not received the promises, but they're waiting to do it with us. Okay? But Christianity brought in a bunch of pagan thoughts and all kinds of ways to scare you. And so they brought in the big carrot of the heaven and the big stick of hell to motivate you. But that's not scriptural. Okay? Anyway, Valentina.
Could you please explain respects in the workplace as a teenager?
Respect?
So the thing is, I have a new manager. She's only been working for like about a month and she's messed up a few times and I don't know how to address it appropriately.
All right. First of all, we need to just, especially for the teenagers who are now working and have these issues, realize that no matter how well you do it, and you may do it really well, it doesn't mean you won't get in trouble or have them get mad at you or try to retaliate. That could still happen, even if you do everything as respectfully as you can. Okay, not all people in management know how to take when something looks like they're being shown up or embarrassed or, you know, corrected by someone who's under them in on some vertical level, right? But you want to be polite. You want to make sure that when you're saying it, say, look, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I noticed that this happened and created a problem and I didn't know what to do when that happens or whatever it is. That's the best way to approach it, is to say, look, I don't know how to approach this, but I noticed something. Because a lot of times, especially with a new job, you may have the manager do something that then causes you a problem and you don't know what to do next. And so you have to ask, well, I don't know what to do when this happens. Especially, this is where it really gets tricky. Manager A says, do this, this, and this, and manager B tells you a completely different way to do it. And then you're doing it the way manager A said, and manager B comes in and goes, why are you doing it like that? I told you the other way. So, well, the other one told me. Especially, this is where it gets really tricky. Manager A is at this level, and manager B is above that person, and you want to do what the person above told you, but the person who you actually interact with all the time told you differently. Now you don't know what to do. My answer is always go to the highest possible person and get clarification. But don't do it in a way that sounds like you're trying to get the person in between you in trouble. Just say, look, this is what's going on, and I don't know what to do because I'm confused, okay? Because I've got you telling me one thing. I remember when Sarah Beth had this over at Mars, all right? You're telling me one thing, and the person right above me is telling me something different, and I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to get anybody else in trouble, but I don't know what to do because you guys are not saying the same thing. So how do I handle this? Now, bear in mind, the person in the middle is still going to get scolded in some way or corrected and then get mad at you. And there's nothing to do to avoid that, okay? But just be polite is what you want to. That's the way, as far as respectful in the workplace, think of it as be polite. And don't try to do something that's trying to embarrass them or get them in trouble and that kind of thing, all right? But you can't avoid dealing with stuff if it's going to cause you a problem, all right? I lost a job over this. Okay, I had a job where I was I was dealing with sections of a place, and I was the one who went around and gave people breaks. And somebody was consistently coming back late from their break, which meant that if I left that section to go to another section, eventually somebody was not going to get a break, and that was going to be me. So I asked my supervisor, I said, what do I do when this happens? Do I leave that section and go to this other section to give the other person a break? Or do I stay here and wait for the person to come back? And they said, well, who's doing this? I said, I don't want to get anybody in trouble. They said, oh, no, no, you won't get anybody in trouble. Well, of course, it did get them in trouble. And then they ended up talking to whoever their little inside friends were and got me fired. So I did everything as proper as I could and still got fired. Okay? Because the people that I got in trouble had been there way longer than me and had connections higher up to get me out of there. All right? And the funny part was I had connections with the person five levels above all of them who wasn't there when it happened. And when I called him up, he said, I can't, I'm new in the position. I can't embarrass everybody between you. I have to let this go, but I'll try to make sure it doesn't happen to anybody else. I said, thanks a lot. Because he agreed that it shouldn't have happened, what happened to me. He said, but he had just started in that position, although he was five levels up. And we had hit it off. So there's no winning in this sometimes, okay? You just got to do it the best you can and accept that the results won't always be good, but you still have to do the right thing because it's the right thing. Does that make sense? Does that help? Okay. Janet, on behalf of Selena, okay?
So she's quoting from Luke 24. And her question is, Rabbi, help me understand what Yeshua's purpose is when he manifests in various scenes after he is resurrected. What is he trying to accomplish? How much of it is supernatural? Because it seems like a lot of the, whenever he's appearing, there is very random. He just comes for a little bit and then he disappears. And I can give you the verses.
I'm familiar with the verses. Okay, I think it's going to need a teaching, okay? Or at least some sort of a session where I can go through and show what the reasoning might have been for each one of those appearances. But there were reasons. There were purposes that he did them for. Each one may be a little bit different than the next because he appeared in different places and did different things in those different places. And so I'll make a note that maybe share that as something I share somewhere along the line as a separate little thing, okay? But it's a good question, but I can't just make a general answer for that. Except to say that he did obviously have purposes, but they were, when he showed up and talked to these guys, it was one reason. When he showed up over here, when they were over gathered over here, there was another reason. So he was trying to do certain things, and I can help lay that out for you, but it has to be verse by verse and lay it out. Okay? All right, Sarah Beth.
Okay. This is referencing back to the gospel readings. It came up in chapters 6, 7, and 8, that Yeshua was healing people without actually being there. And I made a connection. I wanted to make sure it was correct. Would this be similar to, like, when those of us text you, like we say we need something and we text you or get on the counseling schedule with you and Abba either heals us, deals with whatever we need, or, like, we don't even need to counsel with you anymore. Would that be similar?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And thank
because again, just to kind of clarify that, see, when they came to Yeshua, they came saying, we know you can do all of this and they don't even have to be there. Well, it's the same idea. A lot of people will text me about something that's going on. Most people don't have my number, but the few people that do, who I kind of cover, because I cover a few of the people, and they text me saying, I got a situation, please pray. And I'll type back praying. And even if I don't get the message till later, by the time I type it back, it's already been handled. It's because they're trusting that coming to me and getting in the vertical that way is going to bring what they want from him, not from me. And so often enough, it happens like the same thing, like getting on a counseling schedule and then having the answers come before you actually need to be there. Because you're trusting in the vertical and the process. Trust the process. Sorry, that was for Elder Billy. Okay? You're trusting the process, and then the process brings. So that's correct.
My favorite time was I was terribly, terribly sick and a lot of pain, and I just texted you in the middle of the night, or I don't know when it was, but instantly, as soon as I sent the text, the pain was gone.
Amen.
Amen. Can I have a second question?
Sure.
Okay. This is in reference to something that was brought up in a Torah study, Tisera Metzora. You were talking about the personal development teachers. And the question was brought up, like, what if they're secular, pagan, atheist? Like, why should we go to someone who's not using scripture? And I understood your answer about, you know, if we can get one good thing from them, it's worth going. and they don't have to be quoting scripture. I saw a contradiction, something else you teach, which probably means I'm misunderstanding it, so I'm hoping you can give me clarity. When it comes to like the Judaism, you tell us to not study that so much because we can end up in Judaism. Can you clarify those two thoughts so we can make the best decision?
All right. Well, the difference is really, if you're looking for something that's coming from a, we'll call it a religious point of view. In other words, if you're going to study something in Judaism, you're going to study some of their writings and the sages and all these other things, that could lead you into the same thing if you're doing it from a Christian point of view or if you're doing it from Muslim point of view, Buddhist point of view, whatever it is. If you're reading just a book to help you overcome fear or doubt or anger, and it's written more from a secular person who also happens to have a little bit of a Christian spin or this spin or that spin, that's not the same sort of problem as studying Talmud or studying the sages or studying Rambam. You know what I'm saying? It's different from that point of view. Look, by the same token, you know, a lot of people like some of the books on the book for the men and the book for the women for marriage that Rabbi Shalom Arush put together, which he's an Orthodox rabbi. And I really don't find it very appealing, some of the Talmudic and Kabbalistic stuff that he quotes. But I think the points he makes, which he could have very easily made from the scripture, are good. And so my brain goes, I don't mind so much that he used Talmud to make the point, that he could have easily quoted a different verse in scripture to make the point. But from where he's coming from, those are the things he'd rather quote. But if that's where you're focused, the next thing you know, you might end up in the Breslev Orthodox, you know, persuasion, so to speak, and follow in that range, you know, where he's from, okay? And so that's where we want to just be careful that we're not heading in those directions. But, you know, you can't hardly find a lot of the overcoming challenges in our lives, sort of, you know, psychology things and everything, that without finding some that are especially Christian bent, okay, or New Agey bent. Okay, those kind of things. And you have to just be careful with those things. It's kind of drawing you in. All right? All right. Dwayne.
So I was looking at Malachi 4:6. This is referenced in Luke 1:17.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, "And he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children." Could you expound on that at all?
Yes. And I think we're probably going to have you be last. So it's good that you got up here. All right. So There's the concept of turning the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers, all right? So I think that we can obviously look at it from a very literal sort of point of view, that it will help in that respect going between children and parents. But really, I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think it really has to do with the idea, when it says turning the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers, is looking at the elders, like the fathers, like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And that the children's hearts would be in that direction and the hearts of the fathers would be something that would be towards the children, that the children would be looking to embrace that. It has us looking in that way. The children of Israel were chosen because of what the forefathers, Father Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, did in their relationships with Yahweh. Okay? And so, in other words, it's pulling people into that proper vertical. And that would also peripherally bring in the children with their physical fathers, and the physical fathers with children, so that we would love on our children properly. We got a lot of awful dads out there, a lot of really awful fathers, if they're even there, okay? And when they're there, children often wish they weren't there. And we have a lot of children whose hearts are not towards their parents. And so that takes a huge effort, by the way. It doesn't just happen miraculously. You have to work at it. You know, I work very hard at it, and I really enjoy the fruit because of that effort, right? Because I know what it's like to be on the other side of it, because I did not have that with my father. And I made that decision to teach my children differently, to set them a different example. Because my father, from what I understand, I never saw him interact with his father all that much, but my father, the way he describes his father, had the same relationship I had with him. So it was kind of generationally happening. Okay? So did that answer the question? I didn't see where you ended up. Oh, in the back. Okay, yeah? Okay, good. Okay, excellent. So I hope you all enjoyed the Zone 1 session.